are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, June 4th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Rachel Louise Snyder, author of No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. Also on the program today, House Democrats to hold Barr and Wilbur Ross in contempt over the census question. Clyburn walks back his impeachment comments a day later as a Democrat mutiny brews in the House caucus. Former Michigan Governor Rick Snyder has had his digital records, along with dozens others, seized in the ongoing Flint water criminal probe. Meanwhile, a Trump-appointed federal judge quashes the Democratic suit to stop the border wall money reallocation. And a Trump transition figure tied to the Seychelles meeting involving Eric Prince and an emissary from Russia charged with child porno.
Seychelles.
Again?
Those are old charges on that guy. He got charged again?
He got charged in the 80s.
Yeah, in the 80s.
And they found some new stuff.
Oh, Jesus.
Weird how that works out that way.
Diplomacy.
Meanwhile, the Federal Trade Commission adds Facebook to its growing antitrust probe as House lawmakers join the fray. Democrats are going to hold hearings. Speaking of the House, it finally passed a $19 billion disaster aid after Republicans stopped it, what, three or four times last week? Dallas Police Department reports a second killing of a black transgender woman in 2 weeks. Meanwhile, ICE document shows that the detainee deaths were preventable. And the IAEA report, Iran still in compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. We've got a lot to get through to today. This ICE document, great reporting work by Ken Klippenstein over at TYT. Good for them. Good for them. They've been doing a lot of reporting work. Doesn't get as much attention, obviously, as their main show, but they've been doing some very good work over there as of late. So folks should check that out. Ken and Jonathan Larson over there as well. Should tell you straight up, want to wish, well, you know, look, there's been a problem, and I've noticed this over the past several years, and I think it's changing. I feel like we're bringing it back, but for a long time, this time of year, people would just be like, oh, you know, hey, happy, end, your daily fast, the fast that you're doing during the day. No one would say anything about it. It would just be like, hey, how you doing? Oh, good to see you. Happy spring or something like that. Well, it's coming back. Eid Mubarak, ladies and gentlemen. More people are saying it now. It's the end of Ramadan. This was a war on Christmas joke. Eid Mubarak.
I thought Mubarak was someone I'm going to learn about in illicit history on TMBS.
Right. No. Oh.
Eid Mubarak was actually an anti-colonial revolutionary in the Seychelles.
Yeah, no. Eid Mubarak. It's the end of the Ramadan fast. Where they fast for like 30 days during the day.
Well, during the day.
During the day.
Sun up to sundown.
Sun up to sundown.
And then they And then there's a lot of incredibly. I was able to many years ago. I got to have some friends had me over for a break the fast meal. Delicious.
Yeah, I don't know that it's that consistent. Sometimes, like I've talked to people, they're like, "Well, you have cookies in the morning, and then you can do whatever you want. Just hang out. You go out. No tradition." But this guy, I don't know. Different people probably celebrate different ways. Eid Mubarak. Also, it is the 30th anniversary of Tiananmen Square. I can't believe it has been that long. It's sort of terrifying to me in some respects. 30 years ago, about, I don't know, a million people, was it? Or that showed up in the, was it a million people?
I believe it was a million people. I mean, if you think of population proportion-wise.
Right. Yep. It's hard to sort of like figure out these numbers because it's not like the Chinese government was out there advertising. But hundreds of thousands, if not a million people, gathered, protested all around the country, but particularly in Tiananmen Square. They were pro-democracy protesters. And
pro-labor as well. It's one of the lesser known parts of that history.
On the June 3rd, the night of June 3rd, tanks moved into the square, and there was a famous, people I'm sure have seen the video, of a man who basically ran out in front of the tanks and stopped the tanks. He only stopped the tanks probably for, I don't know, about 3 minutes. Eventually some other people came by, and it was never clear to me whether they were his friends or they were some type of like plainclothes agents of the state who ushered him away, and the tanks rolled on. It is unclear how many people were killed when the tanks rolled into Tiananmen Square because, of course, the Chinese government was not going to release that information either. Mike Pompeo made some remarks that were saying to the effect of China has a problem with human rights. Whenever it serves their interests, they will abuse human rights. I mean, the idea that anyone from the Trump administration, which is hosted Duterte and Bolsonaro and others, Putin,
MBS,
would have Netanyahu. A problem with human rights. Netanyahu is sort of laughable, but nevertheless, they went through the motions, and then the Chinese rebuked Pompeo, et cetera, et cetera. But more importantly, let's listen back. Now, this is, I don't know if we have any contemporaneous comments from Donald Trump on Tiananmen Square. Maybe they'll show up. But what we do have is an interview with Donald Trump from, what magazine was this from?
A Playboy magazine.
Playboy magazine.
1990.
In 1990. And for those people who think that Donald Trump has, you know, in his old age, became more authoritarian, this is 30 years ago. When Donald Trump was probably about, 40-ish, 40-something? And back then, in 1990, what were your impressions of the Soviet Union? Their system is a disaster. I was very unimpressed. And then in talking about Tiananmen Square when it comes to China, because he said the problem with Gorbachev, not a firm enough hand. He says, you mean firm hand as in China? And Trump had this to say. When the students poured into Tiananmen Square, the Chinese government almost blew it. Then they were vicious. They were horrible. But they put it down with strength. That shows you the power of strength. Our country is right now perceived as weak, as being spit on by the rest of the world. This was 30 years ago. This seems to be a theme of his for a long time. But both the authoritarian sort of like longing and the notion that somehow our country is being spit on.
Well, he says that another part in the interview, when he talks about how weak Gorbachev is, but he also says, you know, generally a lot of these of their representatives are tougher and smarter than ours.
Yeah.
He said that 30 years ago. I want to just say, just 30 seconds, there was a slightly Gorbachev-like figure in China named, I'm just going to, forgive me, I'm absolutely going to mispronounce this, but his name was Zhao Ziyang, and he was the party premier, and he discouraged the protesters, but he had an open line of dialogue with them and was resisting a call to ruthlessly crack down on them. And eventually, you know, he got sidelined and overruled and went from being at the top of the pyramid to totally politically marginalized the last years of his life.
As we get for being
weak.
Because
he was weak. Right.
So it's nice to know that Donald Trump has been consistent throughout his career. That's always encouraging. There it is, 30 years, Tiananmen Square. I wonder if actually Trump will mention Tiananmen Square. And I wonder, frankly, if he'll mention the end of Ramadan.
I'm going to go, the first one all depends on how the latest phone conversation with Xi went. And the second one, no.
A lot of chocolate cake.
Yeah. Someone just in the Discord of TMBS, I have to say, I don't know if we would put this up, but somebody helpfully found us the cover photo of that issue of Playboy, which will add to the vulgarity and hilariousness of this if you want to see.
Very nice.
Jesus, I don't think I need to see that. Not this early in the morning.
Sorry, this is really bad, but it's...
Also, like, okay, I can feel the contrarian takes coming, but it is somewhat refreshing, at least, to see a representative of U.S. Empire who's not pretending that he cares about human rights.
Yes, that has always been, he said something to that effect, too, and I think in terms of oil, I can't remember what it was, but I do remember tweeting out one time, like, this is the most honest thing that any, yes.
Yeah, this is why all the neocons hate him.
Indeed. He's not hiding the ball. Oof, Jesus.
It's funny, the...
That's still refreshing.
It says the Donald
to
Trump interview...
To hear his endorsement of the Tiananmen crackdown.
It says Donald Trump interview, and the next story is, rock and racism, has the dark side taken over pop music? Oh, yeah, I'll be reading that. Has the dark side... I'm concerned about the dark side.
Thanks for putting that on top. I like that. Appreciate that. Hey, folks, one of today's sponsors is Skillshare. And anyone who goes to skl.sh/majorityreport4, or just go to the podcast description or the YouTube description and click the clickable link, right, Jamie, is going to get 2 whole months of totally free access to Skillshare's entire library of super quality online courses and tutorials. Skillshare is a vibrant online learning community that offers courses on everything from design to video editing, photography, business, technology, meditation, and everything in between. There are Skillshare courses for everyone. You're going to have no problem finding courses that are going to be useful for you, both in your business and in your personal life. And whether you sharpen your skills with something you already love doing, or you want to learn how to do something totally new, Skillshare has you covered. They have courses for entrepreneurs, courses on computer coding, web development, personal nutrition, learning new languages, Photoshop, you name it. I've started to get a little bit addicted to this. And they also now have, I don't know if this is all new, because I didn't notice these before, but they're workshops that, like, you can actually sort of, you don't actually have to physically attend, but that take place over a couple of days to learn stuff. But I'm getting a little bit addicted to this. I don't know what lucid dreaming is, but I'm going to check that out.
It's when you have some sort of consciousness that you are dreaming.
You have an awareness of the dream
state.
That
to me
itself.
Happens all the time.
Yeah, me
but
too.
I'm going to just check
no,
that
no,
out to see if that
works.
It's
not just sleeping poorly. It means an awareness of the dream state. It's a different thing.
You can fly around and stuff.
There's also a course, a productivity masterclass, create a custom system that works. I need that desperately. Desperately. I need to get into that. And then chess openings dominate with the Schliemann Gambit. That's what I'm going to be doing, because I'm going to teach Saul how to play chess, and I want to make sure I'm able to beat him for a long time. It's very important.
That's how they
You'll
learn.
Teach him the game, but not the gambit?
Exactly. Got to keep one in my back pocket. You can get 2 entire months of free access to every single course offered by Skillshare by going to skl.sh/majorityreport4. Just think of everything you'll have at your fingertips for 2 whole months. That's skl.sh/majorityreport4. Of course, course, put a link underneath this on YouTube and in the podcast description. Also, you got to check this out. Whether you're trying to get a sweet deal on something or find the best happy hour in town, what do you do? What do you do, Michael?
When I'm looking for a sweet deal on something or trying to find the best happy hour in town, I have a couple of trusted friends that I ask.
Okay.
Or I go on Google. Sorry, is that the one you were looking for?
Well, you look at
the
reviews
first. I look it up online.
First,
I look
right.
up, oh, of course.
But,
I look up
but if you have trusted friends, great.
That's a form of
do
review.
Do you have any trusted friends who know about software for 700 different types of businesses?
Absolutely not.
Well, you do now.
Thank you.
Because you can read thousands of real software reviews and find the right software for your business, Michael, at your friend, Capterra.com/majority.
I'm personalizing it. I have a friend. This is how we develop our relationship with AI. I love it.
Capterra is the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. Hi, Michael. It's Capterra. You seem like you're really calm. Did you just go away on a talkless retreat?
I wasn't talking for a whole week, Capterra. Are there any new reviews on business software to help me crush the competition?
Over 850,000 reviews of products from real software users, more than 700 specific categories of software. 700 specific categories of software.
That is astonishing.
From project management to email marketing, has everything you need to make an informed decision fast. Join the millions of people who use Capterra each month to find the right tools for their business. Folks, this is an aggregation site. You go there and it is, if you have a business, it is worth going, even if you're not looking for a software, because you probably don't realize there is not just a software, but there are multiple versions and types of software that are suited to your extremely specific business. You a dog walker? There's software for that. Home inspections? Software for that. And not just one type of software. There's multiple versions. And you can go there and read reviews. Visit Capterra.com/majority for free today to find the tools to make an informed software decision for your business. Capterra.com/majority. Capterra, that's Capterra.com/majority. Capterra, software selection simplified. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Rachel Louise Snyder, author of What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us, No Visible Bruises. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program author and associate professor at American University, Rachel Louise Snyder, author of No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. Welcome to the program, Rachel.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Let's start with just how sort of shockingly recent in many respects, the concept, and I know you have an issue with the with referring to it as domestic violence. We'll get to that, but the idea that a spouse could not abuse, or I guess I'm not sure exactly where, you know, from a legal perspective, what constitutes this, but that it's a relatively recent phenomena, not just in human history, but even in the context of this country, that domestic violence was a crime.
Right. Yeah. You know, I was shocked to read that as well. So you're not alone if you're like, you know, blown away by that fact. But yes, it was not until 1984 that there was a federal law against spousal abuse in this country, which, you know, is certainly my lifetime. I mean, I found that shocking as well. In very extreme cases, you would sometimes have charges brought, and there were certain states that had laws much earlier than 1984, but a federal law was not written in this country until 1984.
And so, I mean, so what was I think I know, but I think it's important to articulate what the sort of the theory behind that was, that you can't and we should be clear that when we talk about the domestic abuse, certainly it happens where women batter their husbands, or women batter their wives, or husbands batter their husbands, or but it's generally, right, when we're talking about this generally, I mean, I think just statistically, we're talking about men beating women.
We're generally talking about men beating women, and yes, it includes all those other constellations. And you know, it really comes from the idea that a wife was one's property, and historically it was seen as part of your responsibility to keep your property in line. And so there were not any laws written against spousal abuse, except in extreme cases. There were laws that said things like, you know, you weren't supposed to leave marks, or you were not supposed to leave lasting injury, that kind of thing. So extreme examples, but nothing until the 80s.
Wow. I mean, that's nuts. But I guess that's part of the problem. And let's, yeah, just, in terms,
that's the benefit of hindsight, right? Though, I mean, we have clear eyed hindsight when we look at that and think, wow, that is crazy. But I also think, and I apologize for interrupting, but I also think, you know, the women's movement began at large in the 70s in this country. And I think it's important to point out that social progress does usually precede policy. And so it's certainly true in this case, where women were advocating to not be beaten by their spouses. And finally, 15 years into their message, the federal government got the memo.
Well, and I think this is also important to note, and it's not just in this instance, but just sort of broadly in issues like this, that because there's a federal law, it's not like the trajectory that allowed for this concept that women are their husband's property ended. Right. I mean, legally it may have, but in terms of the cultural forces and the psychological forces that allowed that to exist, that dynamic to exist legally, that trajectory still moves forward. And I think we can see that, at least in the context of I was just blown away by how many women a day in this country die from domestic violence, and that number is going in the wrong direction. Will you tell us more?
Yeah, sure. That's a it's a really important question. You know, I've been on the phone with you for 6 minutes now, and every minute 20 people are beaten in this country. So that's, you know, I'm no mathematician, but that's 120 people just since we've been talking. And that's not counting homicides, which is the second part of your question. There's a researcher at Northeastern University he's been tracking domestic violence homicides for decades, but in 2017 noticed an uptick. So for decades, we've said in this country, 3 women a day are killed by their abusive partners. Since 2017, that number is now 4, which is a 33% increase. I mean, you have things like, you know, you talk about the private problem or the idea of you know, it happening behind closed doors. And you can even see just a week or two ago, the congressman from Mississippi, McLeod, you know, clocked his wife while he was drunk.
Right.
And they issued a statement that didn't at all address his violence, but instead talked about the media getting some of the facts wrong or the context wrong and asking for privacy in this moment. And that underscores the problem. Like, there's nothing in their press release that acknowledges that he did a violent act. I mean, imagine a stranger coming up and clocking his wife.
Right.
You know, like, we would never treat that the same way. So it's galling when you think about what people who claim to love us are able to get away with that a stranger would never get away with, you know?
I want to get back into that concept of how the love, I guess, in this instance, you know, somehow is a mitigating factor or whatnot. But this idea that, or not idea, I mean, this potential reality that the number of deaths has gone up. And I wonder if there's also a commensurate number of domestic violent events, like beatings. In other words, like, how is that possible? Right? Like, I mean, theoretically, we should be moving, you know, we're getting more sophisticated. I mean, you go, one of the aspects of the book is to examine programs that have been started, one particular in Massachusetts. That are, you know, and we'll get to that about how to address this. But broadly speaking, I mean, theoretically, right, we should be getting better at this. There should be the forces that create these scenarios where women are trapped in these situations, both from like a psychological perspective, but also from the sort of material issues. Mm-hmm. These theoretically should be addressed. How is it possible that this is maybe getting worse?
Yeah, I know. It's mind-boggling when you think about it in that way. But another way to think about it, and maybe I'm overly optimistic, but another way to think about it is that at every moment where we've had great social upheaval in this country, it has been met with severe retaliation. I mean, you think about the suffrage movement, the union movement, the civil rights movement. I mean, there was significant retaliation. So my hope, and I guess it is really a hope at this point, is that we're going to look back on this period and it's going to be a moment of great upheaval that led to great progress. Because the fact is, while the numbers are not with us, the numbers are alarming. It's also true that there are people who are doing really incredible work around this issue. And so I do think we're getting better and better. At the same time, maybe paradoxically, that we seem to be kind of taking a step back. But I think part of this is that the Me Too movement, which began in 2017, perhaps not coincidentally coinciding with the rise of domestic violence homicides, I don't know. But I think that has given people a real voice, people who have never spoken before.
I don't want you to speculate. I don't want to push you into speculation too much because we have a whole book full of very well reported facts here and dynamics. But do you think that it's a backlash to Me Too when you say that? When you say it's, you don't, I mean, and I understand this is speculation, but I wonder, you know, we have a rise in hate crime during this era. We have, you know, that demonstrable religious hate crimes, racial hate crimes. There's also, it seems to me, you know, that misogyny played at least some role, significant role in, you know, both in terms of like why people may have voted against Hillary Clinton. I'm not saying it was determinant, but I think it's, we would have to be ridiculous to think that misogyny didn't play a role, particularly when you also had a candidate who was, you know, I think by all accounts, demonstrably misogynist.
Yeah.
Does this like sort of like feeling that exists in the ether, as it were, of our society implicate this stuff or no?
I mean, yes, you're right that it's speculation, but also we don't exist in the world as a series of isolated, you know, issues as, or as people who are disconnected from these things. So, yeah, I think they are all connected. But I also think that, I mean, one of the things that I think that the 2017 elections have done have given a voice to fringe elements too. And, you know, I like to think of, for example, I live in Washington, D.C., like politically really progressive in terms of the people who live here, the actual citizens, you know. And my local bookstore, Politics and Prose, had an incident a couple of weeks ago that you probably heard about. It made national news where the author of the book White Fragility was doing a reading and 10 or so members of the alt-right came in and disrupted the reading and, you know, had a bullhorn and it made national news. And those 10 people were identified, at least half of them were identified within hours. And everybody was outraged. It was terrible, for sure. It was terrible. But at the same time, I looked at that and I thought, wait a minute. These people are from all over the Eastern Seaboard and Pennsylvania and, you know, Georgia, Pennsylvania, South Carolina. They had to go to all these different states just to pull a measly 10 people together in a city of 750,000. Like, yeah, their bullhorn is loud, but we got the numbers. You know, I really believe that.
Fair enough. And so, all right. So let's move on to a little bit more about this. I mean, I think maybe I'm a little bit cynical, but, you know, I don't know if 5 years ago you could have had those 10 people congregate, frankly. And
right.
I imagine for every 10 person, you know, every one person who's willing to go with a bullhorn and travel X number of miles to go protest a book reading about white fragility, there's, you know, I don't know what the algorithm is and how many are at home. You know, if it was a little bit closer, they would have gone.
Right.
But with that said, let's talk about some of the myths that exist about domestic violence. Or maybe we should just start with, why is the term domestic violence problematic?
Well, I think anytime you add the word domestic onto something, it softens it, right? I mean, think about international terrorism versus domestic terrorism. It sounds somehow softer. There's a juxtaposition of those two words in relationship to one another. So I think that's part of the problem. But it's also just an abstraction. You know, it was meant to replace wife beating or battered woman syndrome, which is terrible, but at least in terms of imagery, those provided something that felt, that you felt in your gut. And I feel like domestic violence doesn't do that. It also doesn't get at the particular psychology of domestic violence. And part of that has to do with the worst elements of it being psychological, not physical. So there are people in the book, for example, who, one woman, her husband used to break CDs and threaten to slit her throat with them. There were no visible bruises, to quote my own title, no visible bruises in that scenario. And yet she lived under this threat of such extreme violence. Another one used to throw a blanket over her head and duct tape her around the neck. No bruises there either. So what do you call that? And I call that terrorism. I call that a form of intimate terrorism or intimate partner terrorism.
And you open the book with a story of a couple that ultimately led to death. Rocky and Michelle, where this guy would keep a rattlesnake. Tell us about that story, just to give us a sense of why, how that also manifests this idea.
Yeah. So Rocky and Michelle were a couple in Billings, Montana. They met when she was very young. She was 14. He was 24, which is not uncommon. She was pregnant by 15. She had two kids by the time she was 17, still graduated high school on time, but he managed to just begin to slowly isolate her. And it's this corrosion that is so, this kind of corrosion of self and agency that is so pervasive in these relationships. And he would say things to her like, "Oh, I know your family doesn't like me. I don't want to go over there." And she would, out of loyalty, then, you know, stay with him or be with his family on holidays or whatever. And he wouldn't let her work outside the home. He wouldn't let her wear makeup, wouldn't let her have people over, friends over. He told her they were a bad influence on the kids. And eventually, you know, it escalated and escalated until in the months before he killed her and killed their two kids and then killed himself, he had gone to the outskirts of Billings and got a rattlesnake and brought it home and kept it in a cage and threatened to put it in bed with her or in the shower with her if she got out of line.
So
it's chilling. It's chilling.
And you describe in this, you know, the part of this is about or a lot of it. And I think we'll get into this in a little bit more in terms of like it's a question of almost in some ways narcissism and control versus violence and anger. Maybe that's a little bit stark, but more broadly, and I want to start more broad and then get narrowed down. Is there a sort of a demographic? In other words, like, I know that part of what, of this story or major part of the story is the inability of women to get away many instances from their partner. And that is a function of like, is there anywhere I can go where my kids are going to be safe? Is there anywhere I can go that I'm going to be safe? I don't have the resources because, as you say, like, you know, these abusers tend to dominate the women in such a way that they don't have their own resources. Maybe they haven't been able to have a job. Maybe they have some instances that weren't allowed to learn to drive or you know, to have a license. Is there like broadly, like a demographic that's involved here, like socio and economic?
You know, there really is not. The people who tend to go to prison for domestic violence tend to be minorities, but that is true across prisons in general. Middle, and they tend to be lower on the socioeconomic scale as well, particularly if they're you know, white or whatever. But, you know, and I think that's partly because middle and upper class white men are able to get away with it, or they have plea deals that send them to anger management classes, like, or batterers intervention classes. The only real demographic, and this is not widely researched or not nearly researched enough, but in the case of familicide, so when someone kills their whole family, we call that a familicide. Those tend to be largely white men, middle or middle upper class. And so you saw that with Rocky and Michelle. They were solidly middle class. They were white. You saw it with the guy in Colorado. His name is escaping me now, who killed his wife. She was pregnant and also killed their two daughters just recently, just last year. You know, or Scott Peterson, another famous one, Scott, you know, Lacey Peterson in California. So these kinds of familicides do have a demographic factor to them, but there isn't necessarily higher instances of domestic violence in one community over another.
Is there, is it easier? I mean, it seems intuitively that it would be easier for women of means to get out of this situation, but does that cut against maybe sort of the psychological aspects of this? I mean, I guess what I'm asking on some level is like, how much of this is structural and sociological and how much of this is psychological?
Well, I mean, you know, it's a complicated question, and it's partly why when we ask the why didn't she just leave question, it's so misunderstood as to what we're actually seeing. So let me try and unpack it using Michelle's story. Michelle was not able to work, but she was able to attend college classes. But because she was so young, when she went to Montana State University to sign up and she applied for financial aid, they said, oh, well, you don't qualify because you don't have tax returns. You know, you're too young to be independent. And she said, I've been living on my own. I've got two kids, you know, and she wasn't married to Rocky at the time. And they said, well, marry him and then you'll be his dependent and then you'll qualify for financial aid. So she's taking classes to try to get a nursing degree to leave this man so that she can raise her kids and be economically stable. And she's forced to marry him by the quote unquote system. Right. It's just one. That's just one example, one life. But the message is given to victims in other ways, too. when Michelle only called the police on Rocky once, actually it was her mother, not her, but they were only called one time, and they came and they arrested Rocky, and his parents bailed him out immediately. And she, by the time she found out that he was getting bailed out, he was already out. And so as a means of protection against his escalated retaliation, she went and recanted everything. She said she had made up the stuff about the snake. She had made it all up. And so the prosecutor never pressed charges. That is such a common scenario, because what happens is abusers give victims the message that they are stronger than the system. And then that message is underscored when the system puts the abuser's freedom, prioritizes the abuser's freedom over the victim's rights to live safety free. It's also underscored when we say, oh, we've got a solution for you. And that solution is shelter. You've got to leave your house. You've got to leave your community. Your kids have to leave whatever, you know, sports teams they're playing and go live in isolation with other traumatized people. It's really quite a terrible answer when you think about it.
In fact, that's one of the myths, or a couple of the myths that you discuss, the idea that shelters are largely effective, that restraining orders are largely effective. Before we get to, you know, sort of what can be effective, why else are those ineffective? I mean, is that just from a statistical standpoint, or is it just because there's no, there's no support from there, that there's, that it's like a, they're not being mainstreamed? What is problematic, and why is, about the ineffectiveness of those solutions, I guess?
Yeah, that's a good question. I always thought that shelter seemed a very adequate answer. I mean, I was like, oh yes, we've got this problem solved. We're sending people to shelter. You know, the problem with shelter is complicated. First of all, there's not always room. In fact, in a place like DC where I live, there is always a much higher demand than there is availability. But the other problem is that you're putting the impetus for change on a victim, which really doesn't happen in any other crime. Like, I liken it to, you know, getting your home burgled and having the police come and say, my goodness, this is terrible that your home has been burgled. Well, we're going to have to take you out of your home, but we're going to leave the burglar here to live here.
Right.
I mean, it's ridiculous. You know, traditionally, shelters have not allowed you to bring a family pet. They have not allowed boys over the age of 12. They allow maybe two or three suitcases. You're housed in one room together with your kids. There are rules to a shelter that may or may not be, you know, rules that you generally live by, curfews and things. You're not allowed to have friends over. You're not allowed to work, because that would give away the location of the shelters. So they're abysmal responses. But the biggest problem with them, I think, is the idea of them as a symbolic reference. In other words, we have what has historically been called a private issue, right, between family members. And then we just take that and we take the victims and we move them from behind one set of closed doors to another set of closed doors. So there's, maybe it's because I'm a literary person or, you know, creative writing professor, but there's a symbolism to that that feels completely wrongheaded to me.
In terms of like maintaining some sense of shame or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So, there seems to me to be two things to address. I mean, one is the support for the victims and a means in which to prevent victimization. And then in the event that you don't prevent victimization, you're trying to essentially get the victim out of that situation or protect them. Is there anything for that first part? Like, I mean, what, aside from sort of culturally saying, to women, like, you need to, you know, that you should have self-esteem, or that there are certain parameters, or, I mean, is there any way to prevent, and I want to get obviously to the perpetrator side, because we don't, you know, I mean, I guess to a certain extent we do this, right? Like, don't, if you know, if a cop sees you on the subway and, you know, your backpack is open, they'll say, zip up your backpack. You mm-hmm. don't want to get, you know, there are some, you know, there are some preventative things that you can do. But I mean, is there an equivalent to that? Or is it just simply something that, like, should only be done from the, I guess, the supply side of this crime?
I didn't mean to laugh that was, I've never heard it like phrased.
Right.
Like,
well, it's probably not appropriate because it implies that there's a demand of this, but I mean, there's a, but I mean, do you see what I'm saying here? Is it, I mean, this is a, you know, a unique thing in that respect. I mean, I guess, I mean, because we would say like, okay, lock your door. If you don't want to get robbed. I don't know how you prevent, if there's anything to prevent from the beginning. Like, don't get into an abusive relationship, but there's psychological issues that are involved in that as well.
Yeah, I mean, there is certainly a cycle of abuse, right? I mean, I know you want to get into the perpetrators later, but it's important to point out that most perpetrators have abuse in their own childhoods. So this is simply a cycle. And I think in terms of the long term, part of disrupting the cycle is starting education in middle school, because cases like Michelle are not at all unusual, that they meet someone at 14. It's this heady kind of love, and they're the word corrosion. I use that really deliberately because that is what it feels like. You know, any of us, if we stood at the receiving end of a punch, would leave immediately. But domestic violence doesn't happen that way, right? It happens with like, oh, honey, you know, I see the way some men are looking at you the way when you walk down the street when you're wearing that, and I feel like for your own protection, you shouldn't wear that short skirt, or you shouldn't wear so much makeup, right? It's this slow kind of chipping away at one's own sense of agency. And, you know, I have to say, we have expectations about, I think, that the abuser is, you know, evil and the victim is completely innocent, and that is the scenario. And the first thing I want to say is that in sort of lower levels of domestic violence, you find that women are abusers just about as often as men. There is research that points to that. I'm not talking about the high risk, most dangerous cases. I'm talking about the like slapping the cell phone away from somebody or whatever. But that, you know, also I've lost my train of thought now in the gendered. Go ahead.
Well, I was talking about, like, you know, what can be done. You know, you said intervention at middle school.
That's right. Intervention. Yes.
And I would imagine that intervention should happen both for potential perpetrators and potential victims.
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, when you're 12, you're probably in terms of like a, you know, an adult relationship, you're neither.
Right.
So you're sort of like an open book. And I feel like, you know, gendered education needs to happen really young. You know, I live in DC. Again, it's a really progressive place. About a month ago, my daughter's public school, she's in elementary school, had like a girls' celebration day. Empowerment Day, it was called. And I was like, that's great. But the thing they did was braid the girls' hair. That was their sense of empowerment. And I thought, okay, first of all, you are acquiescing to what you believe a girl is supposed to look like. Second of all, and this is more important to me, they did not include the boys. So none of the boys even knew it was Girls Empowerment Day. That's not gender education. I mean, I just am like, what? And this is one of the most progressive cities in the country. So again, like that, something like that is not, you know, causing girls to be victims and boys to be abusers, but it does get at a sort of misguided idea of who needs to be taught what, how, and when.
All right. Well, let's talk about the perpetrator side of this, because one of the myths you also talk about is the idea that abusers never change. And, we have this sort of dilemma, I guess, to a certain extent. I mean, or not one that I would imagine, and you've said that people of color are more subjected to getting sent to prison And I would, and I don't know if there is research on this, but just based upon what we know in policing, broadly speaking, that generally black people are sent to prison with a higher rate for the same offenses than white people are. And so, I mean, what? How do we address this on the perpetrator side? And is that different from how we would address just violent crime in other contexts? And if so, why should it be that way? I mean, you know, we started off by talking about this congressman who, you know, we got to keep this private. It's a family thing, this this beating, essentially.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I can speak to other crime, like in general, in terms of incarceration. I feel like that is you know, that is Michelle Alexander's place. But I will say that I would separate out and I'm going to use the phrase domestic violence because that's what we're all talking about and that's what we understand. But I would separate it out from the kind of highest risk, most dangerous perpetrators to ones that get heated in an argument and say things that they later regret. Right. I'm not sort of dealing with that. I'm dealing with that former, that most dangerous. And I think that, you know, whether or not somebody who is violent can be made to be nonviolent, I want to believe that they can. I sat in on batterers intervention groups from coast to coast, and I learned the shocking fact that men who are abusers are not identifiable from the general populace, right? They're just average guys who are not rageaholics. They are not people who are out of control. In fact, they are very, very in control. And they are often very charming and manipulative. And that's how they get that's how they get their victims to fall in love with them in the first place, is that they're very charming. After writing this book, I have to say, I never believe in love at first sight. I am incredibly skeptical of someone who 2 months in is saying, I love you, I love you, I love you. It's made me a little bit cynical. But I think that as something that we address as a society, we're really still in the infancy of trying to get violent people to become nonviolent. So we didn't even start batterers intervention programs or offender intervention until the late 80s. So and social science just does not work that quickly. So the efficacy of these programs is questionable. But I still think that the individual exercises in some of them are astounding and potentially life-altering for people who actually want to make a change. And I met plenty of guys who knew they were violent and didn't want to be violent, but didn't have any other skill set, didn't know how else to be in the world. And for guys like that, I think they can really work. I think they can be meaningful.
Let's step back and just also now talk briefly about what the system can do, right? I mean, to the extent that we can work with the perpetrators and perhaps, help the perpetrators. We've talked a little bit about the deficiencies in terms of helping the victims, but you write about, Jacqueline Campbell's 20 risk factors that, and we don't need to go through all of them, although if there's a couple that stand out for you, please tell us. But the idea is to integrate the various services that may come in contact with the victim or the perpetrator and increase the communication so that things can be more effective, right? That's basically what came out of this Boston program,
right?
Massachusetts
right.
program, I guess.
Right. So there's a number of things that we can do, and there are huge, systemic things that we can change, but also there's a number of really small tweaks that we can make, like that every jurisdiction can make. One of them is incorporating what you just mentioned, the Jacqueline Campbell created the danger assessment, and anybody can go to the website and look at these 20 highest risk indicators at dangerassessment.org. And some of them are things like threats to kill, strangulation, beatings while pregnant. They're all signs of increased dangerousness. Jurisdictions can look at their bail statutes and figure out if they can hold somebody for dangerousness longer. In the case of Rocky and Michelle, one of the things that the state of Montana did, which is just mind-boggling in terms of like how it would seem insufficient on the face of it, was that if someone is arrested for domestic violence now, they cannot see a judge until after lunch. So, you know, Rocky bailed out kind of first thing in the morning. That would no longer be allowed in the state of Montana. It seems so unimportant, but what it does is it gives a domestic violence advocate enough time, just a few hours in the morning, to go over and make a safety plan with the victim, to get her into shelter if they need to get her into shelter, to get locks changed on the house, to get an abuser on GPS monitoring, maybe. So there's a lot of little tweaks like that.
Just the literally the first thing in the morning type of situation.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. I would also say that judges need to be educated on the difference between anger management and batterer's intervention. They are not at all synonymous. The psychology behind them is not the same. So, you know, like Ray Rice at the NFL got sentenced to anger management and then his charges were dropped. I mean, it just are thrown out, not dropped. But, you know, that's just a real misunderstanding of the psychology of domestic violence. So there are all kinds of things. And of course, the other thing, and this is controversial in America, but the other thing is to take guns from abusers. If you are charged with domestic violence and found guilty, you are not supposed to have access to guns under federal law. But very few jurisdictions actually implement that.
You also talk about, I think, research that showed that someone went into a prison and talked to, I don't know if it was a dozen or so men who had killed their wives or their partners. And the vast majority of them said that if they didn't have access to a gun, that woman would be alive today.
Yeah. Yeah. 11 of the 14. That was a book called Why Do They Kill by David Adams. And he asked that question that he asked, you know, 14 of them who had killed their spouses with guns, men, and 11 of the 14 said they would not have killed her if they wouldn't have owned a gun or a gun wouldn't have been readily accessible in that moment.
So if we have all these sort of like disparate things that could be done, and like, is this something that has to happen on a community by community basis, or is there any role to be played for like a broad public policy initiative by the federal government or, you know, just, you know, at large? I mean, the only thing I can say is that the one thing that I did notice in the course of the government shutdown was that domestic violence centers, I guess, or, you know, advocacy groups or shelters were some of the first victims, as it were, of the government shutdown. But I don't know if there was any like broad policies associated with that other than just sort of funding for programs.
Yeah, well, the simple answer to that question is yes and yes. It needs to happen in individual jurisdictions, but the federal government can do a lot. First of all, by instituting VAWA, the Senate still has not reauthorized the Violence Against Women Act. The 2018 reauthorization is just being held up in the Senate. It passed the House, but not the Senate. So that's a number one. Well, let's get together and ask Mitch McConnell, shall we? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I have speculation about the fact that it includes more protections for LGBTQ victims, that it includes more protections for Native women and for immigrants, some of whom might not be legal. And that is my guess. It's also that there are gun provisions that the Republicans don't like. I mean, the Democrats want to put stricter gun controls for those who are convicted of domestic violence abuse or domestic abuse. And the Republicans are fighting that. So, I mean, that's my sort of speculative short answer, but that's certainly something that they can do. I think we also can do some national databases, like a national database of stalkers, for example. You know, nearly 80% [S2] Right. [S1] Of victims are stalked in the year prior to being killed. So that seems to me something that would be very simple to implement nationally, is a stalking database. Because right now, as it stands, if you are convicted of stalking in Iowa and you move to Tennessee, no one in Tennessee knows that or has access to those records. And that's a problem.
Well, it's a fascinating book. Rachel Louise Snyder, the book is No Visible Bruises: What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
All right, folks, going to head into the fun half of the program. Disturbing stuff that I think is sort of gives you a sense of sort of some other problems that exist in the context of society. It is going to be interesting to see if there's what kind of research comes out of an increase in domestic violence over the past 2 years, for whatever reason, after it being stable for theoretically for a number of years. It'll be interesting to see if that bears out with you know, in retrospect, with more research. But it's certainly consistent with, and we haven't quite scheduled this interview, but another psychiatrist that I interviewed, a clinical psychiatrist who's done a lot of studies showing that there are pre-existing predispositions that people have that involve racial prejudice, but it is the societal context which not necessarily dictates, but certainly raises the chances that these type of prejudices are going to be acted upon. And it would be, I think, you know, worthwhile to down the road to circle back on some research, whether we're just living in a particularly difficult time when it comes to folks who are marginalized and who have been traditionally disempowered in society.
Yeah, there's also some interesting data on spikes in domestic violence after a war, which makes a whole lot of sense because
yes.
People come home, men come home with PTSD, and they don't have the proper treatment for it.
2017 would not be the year to see that, though. I mean, we would have seen that probably closer to like 08, as you started to have first round of people coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, 2000. I mean, through the
aughts. There are so many causes. I mean, we live in a horrifically violent society. We have an imperial military that's sort of raging against the dying of the light. We have police who are just totally unaccountable. We have so many problems. So it's
right. But why is 2015? Why is the decade before 2016 different from the year 2017?
Oh, I don't know. I'm speaking more in general terms, but I wouldn't be surprised if Trump's election created some kind of spike in the patriarchy.
Yeah. All right. We're going to take a break. Just a reminder, you can support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only make this show possible, but we say thank you by giving you some extra content. Jointhemajorityreport.com. It is your support. If you listen to the show, if you watch the show on a regular basis, by all means, we would appreciate your support. Also, remind you that you also will get the show commercial-free if you're so inclined. You'll always have the opportunity to look at our special deals if we have any in our show descriptions. But that reminds me that Capterra is the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. With over 850,000 reviews, of products from real software users in more than 700 specific categories of software. 700 basically fields of business that you could be engaged in. Small business, big business, that and then multiple different softwares that would help you do that business with thousands of reviews of all of them. Visit Capterra.com/majority for free to make an informed software decision for your business today. That's Capterra, Capterra.com/majority. Capterra, software selection simplified. Today is Tuesday. Michael is back. He's talking. So apparently there'll be a show tonight.
Tonight on TMBS, there is going to be a commentary that will focus on the fallout of the European elections, the rise of liberal parties, a strategy for the left, and Brexit. We'll get into that. Then Hassan Piker makes his debut on the show. We are going to gorge ourselves on the Dave Rubin meltdown, but also explain why that actually matters. It has some stakes and the kind of broader strategy of dealing with YouTube. And then the great Milton Alamadi, who I hope people have heard before on both TMBS and the Majority Report, founder of Black Star News, teacher at John Jay College. We're talking about Thomas Sankara, who's sometimes called the Che of Africa and the history of African awakenings and a bunch of other topics. So Michael Brooks Show, live 7 p.m. on the YouTube channel. Get the whole thing at patreon.com/TMBS.
Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, we have part two of History is a Weapon, number four, that Sean has been doing this awesome series with Matt Chrisman from Chapo Trap House. And they finish off this extended look into the 1970s by talking about all kinds of things, really. Why Carterism fell apart over its own internal contradictions, where the politics of personal virtue have taken us, why Reagan was the man of the hour, and why Clintonism was his enduring achievement, and the birth of neoliberalism and all of the different factors driving it. And yeah, I think the 70s are really important to understanding what's happening today, because I think a lot of Marxist economists were right on the money when they said there was a crisis of capitalist accumulation that started in the 70s. And neoliberalism was kind of like when you don't want to take out the trash yet, so you like push it down a little. That's what Matt Chrisman compared it to. It was like, you know, stopgap measure, but it was temporary, and that's why it's falling apart now. So check it out, patreon.com/theantifada. And it is a bonus for our patrons, but if you cannot afford to spend the money, DM us and we will hook it up.
Matt?
Yeah, there's a new Orweller episode. We're doing Such Were the Joys about George Orwell on his time at a preparatory school as a kid. It's basically, he wrote it toward the end of his life when he was dying. It's sort of 1984 set in a boarding school.
All right.
That sounds so traumatic.
Quick break. Fun half. Don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Get the Majority Report blend. See you in the fun half. We'll be right back.
Mississippi and Sellout Comedy Clubs, and I was on tour for a year with Bill Peterson, and I met literally thousands and thousands of good conservatives who can agree to disagree, who I tell them that I'm gay married, they don't care, or they just are willing to live in the same society as me. I tell them that I'm begrudgingly pro-choice, which is a really hard one for conservatives to swallow, but they can agree to have a conversation about it. I'm against the death penalty. Most conservatives aren't. I mean, all of this shit that I repeatedly say over and over. And I don't get any hate from anyone on the right. And this whole idea and all of these Quillette hippies is the idea is if we build bridges to the right, that that somehow is bad and awful. Even though most of the IDW crew are on, I don't know if they really what they think personally anymore, but are or at least were on the left at one point, right?